Hello and welcome to this week's Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Today, more debate about a common condition affecting mostly young women, the opportunity to increase organ donation in Australia significantly, and are pharmaceutical companies misleading us about what it really costs to develop a new drug? Most of the new cancer drugs which have come onto the market in recent years have had huge price tags, tens of thousands of dollars per course or per year, and healthcare systems are struggling to afford them. One of the reasons given by the pharmaceutical industry is the cost of developing and bringing one of these drugs to market and fulfilling the regulatory requirements for safety and effectiveness. Figures as high as $2 or $3 billion US have been quoted. But a new study has found that the real figure might be a lot less, and that for some companies, the subsequent income has been enormous relative to the investment. One of the authors was Vinay Prasad, who's in the Knight Cancer Institute at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland.
There have been other studies on the topic of the R&D outlay needed to bring a drug to market, but they have all had limits. And we decided to focus on 10 drugs that were sort of a unique natural sample. We picked 10 drug companies that had no drugs on the market that were able to successfully bring a single drug to market out of a portfolio of drugs that often included many other drugs.
Why did that make it easier to study?
So the thing about these drug companies is that they were pursuing a bunch of drugs to bring one drug to market. They didn't have other drugs already on the market. And the reason that that matters is that some of these large companies that have many drugs on the market, much of their R&D outlay in the Security and Exchanges filings, it might be for developing those drugs that are already approved for perhaps off-label uses or perhaps other indications, and not really about bringing a new drug to market. By focusing on these companies, we could focus on the cost of bringing a new drug to market.
Just to be clear, if you're talking about a large established pharmaceutical company, they've got a big portfolio of cancer drugs, rheumatic diseases, heart disease and so on, and you can never be quite sure whether the R&D for one entity is in fact purely for that entity. It could be mixed with a whole sort of other issues and drugs.
Exactly. Their R&D spending for these big companies that have so many products, part of it might be to bring a new drug to market, but the other part might be to further push the market share of existing drugs. And the other thing to point out is that these companies have enjoyed rather lavish profits for many years, and they may have become bloated or inefficient at bringing drugs to market, and their R&D costs may become exaggerated.
So these were kind of young and hungry drug companies who were pursuing a vision of a drug, all in cancer?
Yes, that's right. They all had a drug product approved by the Hematology or Oncology Drug Products Division of the US FDA.
So just give us a flavor of what sort of drugs they were and for what conditions.
We had drugs in this sample that treated very common types of leukemia, drugs in this sample that treated prostate cancer, a drug that treated lymphoma. These drugs really span the range of the sorts of uses of drugs in hematology and oncology.
And you took the R&D costs from what they filed to the Securities Commission.
That's right. For each of these compounds, we identified the date the company bought the drug, and we included the cost of purchasing that compound. Or for the companies that developed the drug, we found the first instance that drug was ever mentioned in the biomedical literature, and we gave them 2 years on top of that.
And what did you find?
What we found was that the cost to bring a single cancer drug to market was about $650 million. And if you allow the company to have a 7% lost opportunity cost, or basically you say that had the company not developed this drug and invested this money instead, and you give them some credit for that, then the cost comes to about $750 million. But that's notable because it's much lower than the prevailing figure of $2.6 billion, which comes from the Tufts Medical Group.
And you feel these figures were accurate?
I think we're pretty confident that we're putting our finger on the pulse of what it actually costs to bring a cancer drug to market. Our methods are fully transparent and open. Anyone with an internet connection can check our work. And that's something that sets us apart from the other major analysis on this topic by the Tufts Medical Group, where all of the data are proprietary secret and no one has had the chance to examine it. Anyone can look at our numbers.
So the other side of the equation is what money they made, and it's not a crime to make money. Some of them are quite extraordinary. So whilst your average was in the, towards $700 million, there was one drug, enzalutamide. Their cost of development in R&D was $473 million, and their revenue was $21 billion. Another one for ibrutinib, the cost of development was $388 million, and the revenue was $22 billion. That's nice work if you can get it.
That's an incredible margin, and you don't see margins like that in any other sector of the economy. And the other thing I point out is that drug enzalutamide, that drug was heavily funded through NIH or U.S. taxpayer funds, so much so that actually Bernie Sanders last year proposed that the U.S. government could actually march in on that drug and actually manufacture that drug at a much lower cost, because so much of the investment for that drug came from the NIH, and that had been proposed but rejected. And what we found basically was, although it cost about $7 billion to bring these 10 drugs to market, just within 4 years of being on the market, collectively, these drugs made $67 billion out of an investment of $7 billion. That's an unheard of revenue after approval. That's a really great margin.
So a lot of these drugs, enzalutamide is not one of them with the $21 billion revenue, but had orphan drug status from the Food and Drug Administration. This means that they've produced a drug for a rare disease where it may not be commercially viable, therefore they get advantages. Now, not in cancer, but in childhood genetic diseases, some of these orphan drugs can cost $1 million a year. You just rely on the fact that there's only three children in Australia, for example, getting them. But does the orphan drug status artificially boost their revenue?
So the one thing the orphan drug status does here, and we didn't even take that into account in our analysis, is the orphan drug status allows these companies to write off some of the expenditure on late phase clinical trials as a tax deduction. So actually some of this R&D outlay is actually maybe even lower than what we state, because it's actually written off as a tax deduction. And that's something we didn't take into account in our analysis, because it hadn't been taken into account in other analyses, and we want it to be as similar as possible, but it's something that we should keep in mind.
Just going back to the Tufts analysis, which you claimed there was not transparent, where did they get their data from?
And that's the thing, Norman. The Tufts analysis, they got their data from what they call mid-size and large pharmaceutical firms, but they don't tell you the companies, and they don't tell you the years, and they don't tell you the drugs. And so an independent person looking at that study has a great deal of difficulty in actually interpreting it.
Now, there was a debate in the last couple of years over hepatitis C drugs, which cost quite a small amount of money to produce, but were being charged very large sums, you know, $80,000 a course, that sort of thing, although we got it cheaper in Australia. And the argument of the drug company, the manufacturer, was, well, we're charging according to the value that we get. So in other words, if we cure hepatitis C, goes the argument, then we prevent liver transplants, a lot of illness, people get back to work. Therefore, it's worth it to the nation to spend $80,000 on a course. And that's how we've priced our drug, rather than some artificial setting based on our R&D. So to what extent is drug pricing predicated on the R&D costs versus the perceived value in the marketplace?
When it comes to cancer drugs, we formally studied that. We did a paper a couple years ago where we compared the benefit that cancer drugs offer with their annual price. And we actually found for cancer drugs, there was no correlation. Whether you had the most marginal or mediocre drug or a real dramatic drug that really changed outcomes for patients, the price was very comparable, and in both cases, quite horrendous. A very expensive drug.
These are the $60,000 to $80,000 a year drugs in the cancer area, sometimes higher.
That's right. And then the other thing I'd like to say about this question is, one wonders if throughout the history of biomedicine, if everyone who created a really breakthrough product, like Jonas Salk when he made the polio vaccine, if Jonas Salk priced the polio vaccine for the net societal benefit, one wonders if we really would have eradicated polio, or what the price of the vaccine would have been. To some degree, really transformative therapies have been made broadly available for the public health benefit throughout the course of history. And while I recognize and appreciate that profits are an important driver of innovation, I think we have to ask ourselves as a society, have we gone too far and allowed profits that are too great that come at the expense of so many?
The other cost that the pharmaceutical industry would say that they bear in addition to R&D is marketing costs. So they've got to manufacture the drug. They say that these biologics, and they're often what are called biologics, in other words, they're antibodies often, they're not straightforward chemical manufacturing, costs a lot of money to manufacture, and then they've got to get it to market. So they claim that's a very large cost to bear. Have you looked at that?
We have, and at least for certain types of cancer drugs, the small molecule drugs, drugs like imatinib, studies show that the cost to manufacture a year of imatinib is on the order of several hundred dollars to, you know, less than $1,000 US to make a year's supply. And yet the sales price of that drug for many years had been approaching $100,000 per year of treatment. So for many of the drugs, the markup from manufacturing cost to sales price is tremendous. Now, you raise the question about biologics, such as these antibody drugs or the new drug you hear about, the CAR-T drug. And absolutely, the cost to make those drugs is a lot higher than the cost to make a small molecule. but it still is dwarfed in comparison to the sales price. And I'll just give you one example. But in a New York Times article in 2012, Carl June, who actually pioneered the CAR T-cell, was quoted as saying that the cost to make a CAR T-cell should be about $20,000 a person. And just a few weeks ago, Novartis announced the sales price of that medicine will be $475,000 per person,
just to
which
explain,
is still
this
much
is,
bigger than the manufacturing price.
This, just to explain, this is targeted immune therapy where they sort of charge up the immune cells and infuse them back in a personalized sense.
That's right. It's the first therapy that takes a cell out of a body, educates it to fight cancer, and puts it back in the body.
So what are funders to do with this information?
Many nations have made strides towards balancing the accessibility of drugs and the price of drugs, but the United States has lagged behind. You know, in the United States, our main payment body, like the Centers for Medicare Services, they actually cannot...
You're forbidden by legislation to argue the price down. You've got to take the price the pharmaceutical industry offers.
Absolutely. Yeah, we cannot negotiate the price of the drug, nor can we say no to drugs, no matter how marginal they are. Moreover, this is not just for drugs that are approved by the FDA, but drugs that were recommended by one of many expert bodies. So in many ways, in the U.S., the drug market, the payers' hands are tied. They have to pay for this. And so the real question is, what stops the drug maker from charging $1 million a dose, $2 million a dose, or $3 million a dose? And the only thing that stops them from charging those prices is that they don't want to appear on radio programs like this program and on the news. That's the only thing that exerts downward pressure in the United States. You know, our paper actually suggests that one of the persistent arguments against tackling high drug prices is that if you lower the price of drugs, you will stifle innovation. And what we find is revenue after approval is far in excess of R&D outlays, suggesting that there's lots of room to negotiate and to lower drug prices without actually impacting on innovation. I guess the last thing I'd say is that, as you'd imagine, any paper that exerts pressure on the cost of drugs debate is going to create a lot of controversy, and our paper is no exception. There have been a lot of people who are upset about our estimate, and some of that criticism, I think, is fair, but some of it is really off the mark. Part of the reason why this matters so much is that the price of these drugs is so high and the pressure to do something about it is so great. If people believe that the price to make one of these drugs is different than the price in our paper, there's an easy way to answer this question. This doesn't need to be a theoretical exercise. Drug makers can open up their books and allow independent audit of their R&D prices, and that will finally answer this question.
Which answers my last question, which was the generalizability of your findings.
We looked at cancer drugs. So the question is, does our finding apply to all drugs? And the answer is it may not apply to cardiology drugs or Alzheimer's drugs, but actually a lot, and perhaps even the majority of drug development, is in the cancer space and in the rare disease space. And in both of these spaces, some of the prerequisites of drug development are rather comparable. And so our estimate may be on the money for those sectors.
Vinay Prasad, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Vinay Prasad is in the Knight Cancer Institute at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, Oregon. And you're listening to The Health Report here on RN, ABC News and CBC Radio across Canada. I'm Norman Swan. According to a study in this week's Medical Journal of Australia, our organ donation rate could be increased by around 30% if all potential donors in a relatively new category were identified and the families asked. That's a lot of people who could avoid dying on a waiting list for lungs or a heart or kidneys. One of the authors of the paper is Professor David Pilcher, an intensive care specialist at the Alfred Hospital here in Melbourne. Welcome to the Health Report, David.
Thank you, Norman.
We're still way behind a lot of other countries, aren't we, in organ donation rate?
Australia does lag behind other countries, but in recent years, particularly with the efforts that have been put into the sector by Donate Life following a funding boost in 2009, Australia's donation rates have increased, and we've gone from sort of sitting in the 20s to up in the high teens now. I think we're 14.
In terms of our league.
If there was going to be a league table, it's a shame that we have to have a league table for something like this.
But it's good to give you a target.
Yeah.
And Donate Life is the government organisation that oversees organ donation in Australia and tries to encourage more. But you're aiming for a target, I think, of, because you advised Donate Life, we should declare, of 25 per, what's the metric?
Donors per million population.
And we're at about 16 at the moment. So it's a long way to go in 1 year.
We're more like about the 20 mark at the moment. We're almost 21. Yeah, 16 was what we were in 2014. So we've actually moved on a bit and continue to move up.
You should have told the editors at the Medical Journal of Australia, because that's what's in your paper. So we're not doing too bad. Tell me about this new category of donor, relatively new category of donor.
It's a sort of new old category is what it is. Most donors have come are brain dead donors.
So they've been in a motorcycle accident, a road crash.
Absolutely.
Like
the
that.
People with a terrible brain injury who are declared brain dead, but their circulation remains intact because they're still on a ventilator and their heart remains pumping blood around the body. And it's a more controlled situation to then sort of organise a donation process after that. What we've looked at is a...
But also difficult for the family because the heart's still beating.
It's
psychologically.
It's a difficult situation to explain to the family because it's not death in the way that most people in the public understand death. Most people understand death as the circulation stopped and the heart stopped. The donors that we're looking at in this study are actually people who die in the way that the public considered normal death.
Your heart stops beating.
The heart stops beating and then the person's body is taken around to theatre and the donation surgery happens after the heart stops.
The heart stops beating. Now, what sort of circumstances... give me a sense of what sort of person, what sort of situation allows you to take an organ from somebody whose heart stops beating?
Yeah. there's probably sort of two groups. One, the patients who've got severe brain injuries, but they're not brain dead. And you know through doing tests on them, getting people in to examine them, that this person isn't going to recover. And they've got some very vestigial brain reflex left, but nothing else. And in that sort of situation, you have the discussion with the family and would decide with them that we're going to take them off the cardiorespiratory support, off the ventilator, and the person passes away after that. The other group of patients are people who have got a disease of one organ. And for instance, they might have chronic lung disease and they're dying from their terrible lung disease, but they've got kidney function that's perfect. And you're doing the same sort of thing. You're discussing end-of-life care with the family. And what we can do now is actually offer donation to these families, to these individuals, and give them the opportunity to help people after death, which wasn't there when we only looked at brain dead donation.
What about cancer?
Cancer is one of the... There's not many absolute contraindications to donation. Widespread cancer is. There are a few cancers actually where it's okay to donate, particularly localised, say, prostate cancer, for instance. But in general, particularly cancer that's spread throughout the body is a contraindication. You can't be a donor.
So what happens? I mean, if the heart stops beating and you then go to, and the family says yes, and it's a controlled situation where you know it's going to happen. So this is not something that happens at home. This is happening in a hospital. How long have you got? Presumably the heart, you've only got a few minutes.
Yeah, for a heart, you've only got a few minutes. There's a long period in the run-up to it as well. So actually one of the difficulties with this is that you've got to identify someone who's the right kind of person. So you have to pick someone who you're pretty sure that they're actually not going to survive. You've got to identify them as having an organ that's potentially suitable for donation and transplantation. You've got to be able to support them long enough, and you've got to predict roughly when you think they're going to die and have those discussions. And then after that, once the heart stops, there's only a very short period where you've got to take them to theatre to do the donation surgery.
But I think you argue in your paper, really, it's mostly lung donation and kidney donation that allows that sort of flexibility.
Absolutely. When we looked at the patient groups that we had information for, it was mainly donors of kidneys and lungs.
So I've spent all this time explaining and not leaving enough time to talk about your study, but essentially your study looked at the missed opportunity here in patients such as this.
Yes, it did. I mean, this is a growing field, and there's a greater recognition that people can donate through this pathway. And what Australia's lucky, because it's got a good system for measuring the information about people that die in hospitals, and it gave us the opportunity to look to see what the potential is. No other country has been able to do that
before. So what is the potential?
When we looked at it, across the 2.5 years, there were about 500 people that met those criteria to be a donor. And if you think about 60% of them would have said yes. So that comes down to roughly a bit over 100 extra donors per year is what the estimate that we
and
think.
And how many donations are we getting at the moment a year?
At the moment, last year, there were just over 500 donations. Most of them, about 75% of them were brain dead, 25% were DCD, this type of donation.
So what would you like to see that percentage of DCDs going up to?
Yes. Look, I think a reasonable percentage to aim to would be somewhere around the 40-45% mark. And that's theoretically possible by identifying all of these people.
So if you produce these new organs, it's still small numbers really compared to other countries. Can transplant units cope? Some of them are getting pretty busy at the moment.
Yeah, it's a good question, actually. It's a really good question.
As the numbers go up.
A lot of the actual resources that have been put into donation have been put into the identification and the process around donation. The flow-on effect from being successful is that you've got lots of transplants, and lots of transplants need lots of looking after and need resources. It's one of the things that we're seeing with the success of the increase in donors recently is it has put pressure on transplant units to provide resources to look after recipients. It's better having it that way around than the other
way around. It's a nice problem to have, but we're going to have to look at it a bit more closely.
Absolutely, it's important.
David, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
Professor David Pilcher is an intensive care specialist at the Alfred Hospital in Melbourne. Polycystic ovary syndrome, PCOS, is the commonest hormonal disorder diagnosed in younger women. It's associated with weight gain, menstrual abnormalities, infertility, skin problems, and signs of excessive male hormones. A few weeks ago on the Health Report, we covered allegations that because of a change in the way PCOS is diagnosed, up to one in five women could be said to have the condition with questionable benefits. Three leading PCOS researchers reacted strongly to the assertion and have written a strong response. One of the authors is Helena Teed, who's Professor of Women's Health and Director of the Monash Centre for Health Research and Implementation at Monash University, and is here in also in our Melbourne studio. Welcome, Helena.
Thank you, Norman.
So what's your issue with this overdiagnosis allegation?
I think that everybody who works in the field in PCOS knows that their diagnostic criteria can be challenging. So it's a syndrome, which means there's no one simple test we use to diagnose it. And each one of the three features in this condition are a continuum. So we draw an arbitrary line and say that if you have that feature at this level, then you have the diagnosis. That type of diagnosis around a syndrome always creates some confusion and some argument as to exactly where we should draw the line to say someone does or doesn't have it. Our challenge was not so much with acknowledging there are issues around diagnosis of this condition, but the fact that in this day and age it is very difficult to put forward a proposal that we should slow and delay diagnosis for women with a condition on the basis that there may be an overdiagnosis when there's no evidence for that. And in fact, there is, to the contrary, evidence from thousands of women published around the world with this condition that they are underdiagnosed, that the diagnosis is delayed, that the information they receive is inadequate, and that the care could be much better optimised.
So give me, how do you make the diagnosis more specifically then? What are these features? And, you know, just talk that through.
So there are three main features on which the condition is diagnosed. That includes the male type hormone pattern, which is either a blood test or clinical features. So that's excess body hair in a woman is the classic sign. So excess male hormones. The other one is not ovulating. So the eggs actually half develop in the ovary and they don't ovulate and the woman won't get a regular menstrual cycle and will have a lot of difficulty conceiving. And the third one is the most controversial, which is an ultrasound. You can see all of those arrested follicles in the picture. They're called polycystic ovaries. They're not actually cysts at all. They're just eggs that are arrested in their development.
And we've spoken about this before, you don't believe that's a particularly important one, the cysts in the ovary, even though it's got the name of the syndrome.
Yeah, so the challenge with it is that the name of polycystic ovary is actually inaccurate. What it is arrested follicles on the ovary, and it's you need to have two of those three features to have this condition. It is true that women who have those features on ultrasound and only one of the other two have a more mild version of the condition.
Now, some women have a lot of problem with their weight
yes.
in this condition.
Yes.
What proportion?
So in Australia, it's over 70% are overweight or obese, and so they're at an unhealthy weight. It varies in some countries. So in Asia, many women don't have that same weight problem, and it does mirror the general population, Norman, but women with PCOS have a higher rate of weight gain, very well demonstrated in Australia, and a higher weight overall than women without the condition.
And there are also psychological issues.
Major psychological issues. Anxiety and depression, quality of life is impacted. And indeed, that was one of the reasons why we came out in this statement to say this. And it was, there were the three of us who've led in this field for quite some time in Australia, but also the head of the Patient Advocacy Support Program. And it was, in fact, her quite passionate response to the article and the passionate response of women on Facebook, which actually inspired us to respond because they really feel underserved, delayed diagnosis, inadequate information, and then we have an article that purports delaying diagnosis further and treating women without giving them a diagnosis.
So they argue that, by giving the diagnosis too early creates stigma and unnecessary anxiety.
Yes, so the challenge with that, Norman, is there's no evidence towards that at all. There is one study by the authors who published the article where they took young, healthy university students who had no symptoms of PCOS at all. They gave them a hypothetical scenario and then tested whether giving them a diagnosis label is distressing. That is just not reflective of a clinical scenario where you have a young woman who is getting increasing body hair, increasing body weight, irregular cycles, and is really very distressed and anxious, and you give that person a diagnosis, you cannot say that's the same as a healthy young university student.
Now, things are changing with the diagnosis and the guidelines, aren't they?
Yes. So, importantly, and I think this was our key point, it's much more constructive to take an evidence-based approach to the best diagnosis and the way to support women and their health professionals. So, over the last few years, funded by the NHMRC and now by international funders, we have worked very much hand-in-hand with women affected by the condition, and Australia has led an international initiative to develop international guidelines which will clarify some of those issues in the diagnosis, to have a
major... And
it's
a bit different for adolescent girls from adults.
Yes, adult women. Very important. Yeah. I'll come back to that in 2 seconds. To do the guidelines and then to have a major international awareness program to empower women, but also to educate health professionals about how to support them. Adolescent diagnosis is more challenging because PCOS is a bit mirrors some common features of puberty. So the international guidelines recommend waiting 2 years after puberty before making diagnosis, so it's clear that it is the condition, and also recommend not doing an ultrasound because it's not specific enough in young women. Those guidelines are very clear, but that doesn't mean we should delay diagnosis or not support women when they've got the condition.
So briefly, we've only got a minute or so left. What treatment is then, what interventions can you do for women that is actually going to change things for them? Because it's not easy to treat.
No, but it is an area where we can definitely provide education and support. And there's strong calls from women and evidence that we need to do much better in that. So education and self-empowerment is an important part of the treatment in terms of relieving distress and anxiety. Also, lifestyle intervention, especially around prevention of weight gain. We always wait until people get into the unhealthy weight range where it's very challenging. But if we have a young group of women who we know are at increased risk of gain, who have increased metabolic risks, we know we can help them early. So intervening around prevention of weight gain is really important. Talking about early family initiation so that we're not looking at the challenges of excess weight and age as well as PCOS on infertility. And then managing the symptoms with them to relieve the distress the condition causes.
And if they're suffering problems with their periods and finding difficulty with infertility, what percentage can actually have a baby in the end?
Really good news, very good question. So in fact, in Australia, we have good evidence that the majority of women with PCOS go on to have a family, and indeed their family sizes are not that different to women who don't have PCOS, but they often need a little bit of assistance.
Right. So it's not hopeless. There is help.
Absolutely.
Get in early is the message.
Yes.
Helena Teed, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Helena Teed is Professor of Women's Health at Monash University. I'm Norman Swan. This has been The Health Report, and I hope you can join us next week.